Or? I didn't really think it through. I know, big surprise. I just got so amped when I found him. I know he'll have answers for us. He wrote to her, not us. I don't think we can tell her. She's fragile, Neens. Dad was right about that. I know. That's why I wasn't sleeping. We can't tell her we've been researching her life, and we can't just show up at the professor's nursing home, and we can't sneak away for a day after all the fuss I made about us being together. And if we did sneak away, he might not talk to us anyway. It's her he wanted to see. I can see how all that would keep you up, especially with the rest of it. The rest of it? Your nature, Neens. You can't not see him. I know. So what do we do? We will go see the professor. Nina gasped at the sound of her mother's voice and turned around. In her surprise, she caught the side of her cup on the railing and hot chocolate splashed everywhere. Mom! Meredith stammered. You heard it all, Nina said, licking chocolate from her fingers. She knew she looked calm. It was one of the many things photojournalism had taught her. How to look calm, even if your insides were shaking. But her voice was uneven. Things were going so well with Mom lately. She hated to think she'd ruined that. I heard enough, Mom said. It is the professor from Alaska, yes? The one who wrote to me years ago. Nina nodded. She pulled the blanket off of her and Meredith and carried it over to Mom, wrapping it around her thin shoulders. It was me, Mom, not Meredith. Mom held the blanket closed at her breast, her fingers pale against the red plaid. She glanced at the deck chair beside her and sat down, covering herself carefully with the blanket. Nina and Meredith took chairs on either side of her, flipping the blankets out too. A steward came by and offered them each a hot chocolate. I'm sorry, Mom, Nina said. I should have told you at the beginning. You thought I would not agree to the trip. Yes, Nina said. It's just that I want to get to know you, and not only because I promised Dad. You want answers. How can we, she said, including Meredith in this, not want answers? You are part of who we are, and we don't know you. Maybe it's why we don't know ourselves. Meredith can't figure out if she loves her husband or what her own dream is. And I've got a man waiting for me in Atlanta, and all I can think about is Vera. Mom leaned back onto the teak chair. It is time, I suppose, she said quietly. Your father spoke to Professor Adamovich, I believe. Although I never did. He thought we should talk. I should talk. It's probably why he kept the letter all these years. What does the professor want to talk about? It was Meredith who asked this, and although her voice was quiet, the look in her eyes was intent. Leningrad, Mom said. For years, the government hid what happened. We Soviets are good at hiding things, and I was afraid to talk about it. But there is no reason for fear now. I am 81 years old tomorrow. Why be afraid? Tomorrow is your birthday? They said it once. Mom almost smiled. It was easier to hide everything. Yes, tomorrow is my birthday. She sipped her hot chocolate. I will go see this professor with you, but you two should know now. You will be sorry you began all of this. Why do you say that? Meredith asked. How could we be sorry to learn who you are? It was a long moment before Mom answered. Slowly, she turned to Meredith and said, You will. Ketchikan was a town built on salmon, catching it, salting it, processing it. The rain gauge, called the liquid sunshinometer, attested to the dampness of the climate. "Look at that," Meredith said, pointing to a grassy area across the street where a man with long black hair was carving a totem pole. A crowd was gathered around him, watching. Nina dared to reach for her mother's arm. "Let's go check it out." She was surprised when Mom nodded and let Nina guide her across the street to the small park. Rain started to fall as they stood there. Most of the crowd dispersed, running for cover. But Mom just stood there, watching the man work. In his capable hands, the metal instrument cut and gouged and changed the wood from rough to smooth. They saw a paw begin to appear. "It is a bear," Mom said. And the man looked up. "You have a good eye," he said. Nina could see how old he was. His dark skin was lined and leathery, and the hair at his temples was gray. "This is for my son," the man said, pointing to the beaked bird at the base of the totem pole. "This is our clan, the Raven, and this thunderbird brought the storm that washed the road away. And this bear is my son."
"So it's a family history," Meredith said.
"A burial totem, to remember him."
"It's beautiful," Mom said. And just then, in the falling rain, Nina heard the voice of the fairy tale, and for the first time it made sense. She understood why her mother only told the story in the dark, and why her voice was so different. It was about loss. The voice was how her mother sounded when she let her guard down. They stood there long enough to see the bear's claw take shape. Then they finally walked toward Creek Street. Here, the old red light district had been transformed into a boardwalk of shops and restaurants positioned above a river. They found a cozy little diner with a view, and sat down at a knotty pine table by the window. The street outside was full of tourists with shopping bags, moving like wildebeests in the migration season from one store to the next, even in the rain. The bells above the store doors were chiming a random tune. "Welcome to Captain Hook's," said a cute young waitress dressed in bright yellow overalls and a red checked blouse. A yellow fisherman's hat sat firmly on her brown curls. A name tag identified her as Brandy. She handed them each a large laminated menu in the shape of a fish hook. In no time at all, the waitress returned to take their orders, which were 3 fish and chips baskets and iced teas. When she left, Meredith said, "I wonder what our family totem would look like." There was a moment's pause after that. In it, they all looked up, made eye contact. "Dad would be at the bottom," Nina said. "He was the start of us." "A bear," Meredith said.
"Nina would be an eagle." An eagle. A loner, ready to fly away. She frowned a little, wishing she could disagree. Her life had left markers all over the world, but very few at home. No one's totem would include her except this family's, and while that was what she'd always wanted, to be totally free and independent, it felt lonely just now. Meredith would be a lioness who cares for everyone and keeps the pride together.
"What would you be, Mom?" Meredith asked.
Mom shrugged. "I would not be there, I think."
"You think you left no mark on us?" Nina asked.
"Not one that begs to be remembered."
"Dad loved you for more than 50 years, Meredith said. "That's not nothing."
Mom took a sip of her iced tea and stared out the window at the rain. The waitress returned with their food. Nina got up quickly and whispered a request and then sat down again. As they ate the delicious halibut and fries, they talked about the day in Ketchikan, the gold nugget jewelry in the windows of the shops, the ornate First Nations tribal art,
the Cowichan sweaters the locals wore, and the bald eagle they'd seen perched on a totem pole in town. It was a conversation that could have been had by any family on vacation in town, but to Nina it felt almost magical. As her mother spoke about things that interested her, she seemed to soften. It was as if every ordinary word loosened something in her until by the end of the meal she was smiling. The waitress returned and cleared their plates. Instead of placing the bill on the wooden table, she set a piece of birthday cake in front of Mom. Its lit candle danced above the buttercream frosting. "Happy birthday, Mom," Meredith and Nina said together. Mom stared down at the candle. "We always wanted to have a birthday party for you," Meredith said. She reached out and put her hand on Mom's.
"I have made so many mistakes," Mom said softly.
"Everyone makes mistakes," Meredith said.
"No, I didn't mean to be that way. I wanted to tell you, but I couldn't even look at you. I was so ashamed."
"You're looking at us now," Nina said, although it wasn't strictly true. Mom was actually staring at the candle. "You want to tell us your story. You always wanted to. That's why you started the fairy tale." Mom shook her head.
"You're Vera," Nina said quietly.
"No," Mom said. "That girl is not who I am."
"But she's who you were," Nina said, hating herself for saying it, but unable to stop.
"You are a dog with a bone, Nina."
She sighed.
"Yes. Long ago, I was Veronika Petronova Marchenko."
"Why, enough," Mom said sharply. "This is my first birthday party with my daughters. There will be time later for the rest of it."
21. At dinner, they talked about ordinary things. They drank wine and toasted again to Mom's 81st birthday. After a delicious meal, they wandered through the Vegas-like glitter of the giant ship and found their way to a theater, where a man in an orange sequin jumpsuit was performing magic. He made his barely clad assistant disappear, gave her paper roses that turned into white doves and flew away, and cut her in several pieces and then put her back together. Mom clapped enthusiastically at each new trick, smiled like a little kid. Meredith could hardly take her eyes off her mother. She looked bright and almost happy. For the first time, Meredith understood how cold her mother's beauty had always been before. Her beauty was different tonight. Softer. Warmer. When the show was over, they walked back to their staterooms. In the crowded hallways, amid all the chatter of their fellow passengers and the ringing of the casino bells, they were strangely silent. Something had changed today with that little burning candle on a piece of chocolate cake. But Meredith didn't know quite what had changed or how they would be reshaped by it. All she knew was that she had lost the ability to stay separate now. For more than 25 years, she'd kept up her side of the wall, too. She had refused to really see or need her mother. And in that distance, she'd found strength. At least, a facsimile of strength. Now she had almost none of that left. Truthfully, she was glad it was too late to hear more of the story tonight. At their door, Nina stopped.
"I had a great day, Mom. Happy birthday."
She moved forward awkwardly, pulled Mom into an embrace that was over before Mom could lift her own arms. Meredith wanted to follow suit, but when she looked in her mother's blue eyes, she felt too vulnerable to make a move.
I know you must be tired," Meredith said, smiling nervously. "We should go to bed and get up early. Tomorrow we'll be cruising Glacier Bay. It's supposed to be spectacular."
Mom said, "Thank you for my birthday," so softly they almost couldn't hear it. And then she opened the door and went into her room. Meredith unlocked their door and went inside.
"Dibs on the bathtub," Nina said, grinning.
Meredith barely noticed. She grabbed a blanket from her bed and went out onto the small veranda. From here, even in the darkness, she could make out the coastline. Here and there, lights shone, marking people's lives. She leaned back against the sliding door and wondered at the vistas she wasn't seeing. It was all out there, the mystery, the beauty, beyond her ability to see now, but there just the same. It was simply a matter of timing and perspective, what one saw. Like with Mom. Perhaps everything had been there to be seen all along, and Meredith had had the wrong perspective, or not enough light.
"I suppose that is you, Meredith."
She was startled by the sound of her mother's voice, coming from the darkness of the veranda to her right. It was another jolt of reality. There were hundreds of tiny verandas stuck out from the side of this ship, and yet in the dark, each one seemed entirely separate. "Hey, Mom," she said. She could only make out the merest shape of her mother, see only the white sheen of her hair. They were alike in that way, she and her mom. When they were troubled, both wanted to be outside and alone.
"You are thinking about your marriage," Mom said.
Meredith sighed. "I don't suppose you have any advice for me."
"To lose love is a terrible thing," Mom said softly. "But to turn away from it is unbearable. Will you spend the rest of your life replaying it in your head, wondering if you walked away too soon or too easily, or if you'll ever love anyone that deeply again?"
Meredith heard the softening in her mother's voice. It was like listening to melted pain, that voice. "You know about loss," she said quietly.
"We all do."
"When I first fell in love with Jeff, it was like seeing sunlight for the first time. I couldn't stand to be away from him. And then I could. We got married so young."
"Young has nothing to do with love. A woman can be a girl and still know her own heart."
"I stopped being happy. I don't even know why or when."
"I remember when you were always smiling.
Back when you opened the gift shop.
Maybe you never should have taken over the business."
Meredith was too surprised to do more than nod. She hadn't thought her mother ever noticed her one way or the other.
"It meant so much to Dad."
"It did."
"I made the mistake of living for other people. For Dad, and the orchard, and my kids. Mostly for them, and now they are so busy with their own lives they hardly ever call. I have to memorize their schedules and track them down like Hercule Poirot. I'm a bounty hunter with a phone."
"Gillian and Maddie flew away because you gave them wings and taught them to fly."
"I wish I had wings," Meredith said quietly.
"This is my fault," Mom said, standing up.
The veranda creaked at the movement.
"Why?"
Meredith said, moving closer to the rail that separated the two verandas. She felt her mother come toward her until suddenly they were standing face to face, a foot or less apart. Finally, she could see Mom's eyes.
"I am telling my story to explain.
When it's over, will I know what I did that was so wrong?" In the uncertain mix of light and shadow, her mother's face seemed to crumple like old wax paper.
"You will know when it's all done.
that you are not the one who did anything wrong. Now come inside. I will tell you about the Luga line tonight.
Are you sure? It's late.
I am sure.
She opened her sliding door and disappeared inside her cabin. Meredith went back into the brightly lit stateroom and found Nina on her bed, drying her short black hair with a towel.
You can't see anything out there, can you?
Mom wants to tell more of the story.
Tonight?
Nina jumped up, letting the wet towel slump to the floor, and hurried to the other side of the room. Meredith picked up the damp towel and carried it to the bathroom, where she hung it back up.
You ready?
Nina said from the doorway. Meredith turned to look at her sister.
You have wings.
Huh?
Maybe I'm like some ostrich or dodo bird. I stayed on the ground so long, I lost the ability to fly.
Laughing, Nina put an arm around Meredith and led her out of the stateroom.
You're not some damned ostrich, which, by the way, are mean-ass birds who always stand alone.
So what am I? Meredith asked as Nina knocked on Mom's door.
Maybe you're a swan. They mate for life, you know. I don't know if one can fly without the other.
That's strange, coming from you. You're no romantic.
Yeah, Nina said, looking at her. But you are.
Meredith was surprised by that. She would never have called herself a romantic. That was for people like her father, who loved everyone unconditionally and never failed at the grand gesture. Or like Jeff, who never forgot to kiss her goodnight, no matter how late it was or how hard his day had been. Or maybe it was for girls who found their soulmates when they were young and didn't quite understand how rare that was.
The door opened. Mom stood there waiting, her white hair unbound and her body wrapped in an oversized blue cruise ship robe. The color was so incongruous on Mom that Meredith did a double take. And then it struck her.
Vera sees color, she said.
Beside her, Nina gasped.
That's right. So you see in color.
No, Mom said.
How come?
No questions, Mom said firmly. These were the rules.
She walked over to her bed and climbed in, leaning back into a pile of pillows. Meredith followed Nina into the room and took a seat beside her sister on the love seat. In the silence, she heard waves slapping the side of the boat and the quiet intake of their combined breathing.
Vera cannot believe that she must leave her children again, Mom said softly, using her voice to its fullest power. She no longer looked delicate and old. In fact, she was almost smiling, and her eyes had drifted shut.
Especially when she worked so hard to bring them home. But Leningrad is a city of women now, and they must defend against the Germans, and so, on a bright and sunny day, Vera kisses her babies goodbye for the second time in a week. They are 4 and 5, too young to be left without their mother. But war changes everything, and just as her mother had predicted, Vera is doing what would have been unimaginable even a few months ago. In their small apartment, with all eyes on her, Vera kneels down in front of them.
Aunt Olga and Mama have to go help keep Leningrad safe. You need to be very strong and grown up while we are gone, yes? Baba will need your help.
Leo's eyes immediately fill with tears.
I don't want you to go.
Vera cannot look in her son's sad eyes, so she turned slightly toward her daughter, whom already she had begun to think of as the strong one.
What if you don't come back?
Anya says quietly, trying her best not to cry.
Vera reaches into her pocket for the treasure she had thought to take with her. She pulls it out slowly. In her palm sits the beautiful jeweled butterfly. Here, she says to Anya. I want you to hold this for Mama. It is my most special thing. When you look at it, you'll think of me and know that I will come back to you and that wherever I am thinking of you and Leo and loving you both. Don't play with it or break it. This is who we are, Anya. It proves that I will come back to you. Okay? Very solemnly, Anya takes the butterfly, holds it carefully in her small palm. Vera kisses them both one last time and stands. Across the room, she meets her mother's gaze. It is all there, in their eyes. The goodbye, the promise to take care and come back, and the worry that this is goodbye. Vera knows she should hug her mother, but if she does that, she'll cry, and she cannot cry in front of her children. So she instead grabs a heavy winter coat off the hook by the door and slings it over her shoulder. In no time at all, she and Olga are crammed together in the back of a transport truck, surrounded by dozens of other young women. Many of them are dressed in flowery summer skirts with sandals on their feet. In other times, they would look like girls going off to camp, maybe to the Urals or the Black Sea. But no one would make that mistake of them now. There is not a one of them smiling. When they reach the Luga line, there are people, girls and women mostly, as far as the eye can see. They are building the massive trenches and fortifications that will stop the enemy from reaching Leningrad. Bent above the ground, stabbing at the dirt with pickaxes and shovels, these women are exhausted. Their faces are streaked with sweat and dirt, and their dresses are ruined. But they are Russians, Soviets, and no one dares to pause or complain. No one even imagines doing such a thing. Vera stands in the sunlight, with the forest only a few miles away, while a comrade tells her what to do. Olga moves in close to her, takes her hand. They listen, like soldiers, and look like children, though they do not know this. It is their last moment of peace for many nights. After that, they take up pickaxes and trudge to the line, where the ground has been chewed up already. Dropping into the trench, they become two more in an endless line of girls and women and old men who hack at the earth until their hands blister and bleed, until they cough up blood and cry black tears. Day after day they dig. At night, they huddle in the barn with the other girls, who look as dazed and tired and dirty as Vera feels. The whole place smells of dust and mud and sweat and smoke. On their seventh night, Vera finds a quiet corner in the barn where they stay at night, and builds a small fire of twigs. It will not last long, these flames that feed on so little. So she works fast, boiling a cup of water for her sister, handing it to her. The watery cabbage soup they had for dinner has long ago given way to hunger, but there is nothing to be done about that. Beside them, a heavy-set older woman leans against the bales of hay, looking at her dirty fingernails as if she's never seen her own hands before. Her fleshy, dirty face is unfamiliar, but there is something comforting in her eyes. "Look at my hands," Olga says, putting down her cup of water. "I'm bleeding." She says it with a kind of confused wonder, as if the pain is not hers, nor really even the blood. Vera takes her sister's hand, sees the matted blood and broken blisters on her palm. "You have to keep your hands wrapped. I told you this." "They were watching me today," Olga says quietly. "Comrade Slotkov and Pritkin. I know they know about Papa. I could not stop to adjust the wraps." Vera frowns. She has heard this from her sister before in the past week, but now she recognizes that something is wrong. Olga does not make eye contact with her.
Already they have seen girls die around them. Only yesterday, Olga spent half the day deafened by a bomb that landed too close. Outside, the alarm blares. The sound of aircraft is a faraway drone at first, not unlike the murmur of a distant bee at a summer picnic. But the sound builds, and fear in the barn becomes palpable. Girls move and shift and lie flat, but really there is nowhere to go. Bombs drop. Fires flash red and yellow and black through the slats in the barn siding. Somewhere, someone is screaming. The air turns gray and gritty. Vera's eyes sting. Olga flinches, but doesn't move. Instead, she stares at her wounded palm and begins methodically ripping off the dead, blistered skin. Blood bubbles up from her wounds.
"Don't do that!" Vera says, pulling her sister's hand away.
"Honey." Vera hears the word spoken aloud. At first, it makes no sense. All she can really comprehend is the bombing. Near her, someone is crying. Then she hears it again. "Honey." The old woman is nearer now. Deep wrinkles bracket her smoker's mouth, and purplish bags buttress her tired eyes. She pulls a small vial from her apron pocket. "Put honey on your sister's wounds." Vera is stunned by the generosity of the act. Honey is more valuable than gold on this Luga line. Food and medicine in one.
"Why are you doing this?" Vera says, after she smears a small drop on Olga's wounds.
The woman looks at her. "We are all we have left," she says, scooting back into her place amid the hay bales.
"What is your name?" Vera says.
"It doesn't matter," the woman says. "Watch your sister closely. I have seen eyes like hers before. She is not doing well."
Vera nods bravely, though the words are like a cold wind. She has been telling herself that this change in Olga is ordinary sleep deprivation and hunger. But now she sees what the old woman sees. The speck of craziness in her sister's wide eyes. Olga cannot stand these days and nights, the screaming, the endless work, the horror of watching a girl your own age blown apart. The suddenness of the danger, that's the worst of it. Olga is unraveling. She talks to herself and hardly ever sleeps. She pulls out her hair in clumps.
"Come here, Olgushka," Vera says, pulling her sister into her arms. They crawl back into their bed of hay, which is neither soft nor sweet-smelling.
"I see Papa," Olga says, her voice dreamy-sounding. It is as if she has forgotten who they are and where they are and of whom they do not speak.
"Shh!
Tell me a story, Vera. About princesses and boys who bring you roses."
Vera is weary to the bone, but she strokes her sister's dirty, matted hair and uses the only thing she has, her voice, to soothe their spirits. "The Snow Kingdom is a magical walled city, where night never falls and white doves nest on telephone lines." Long after Olga has fallen asleep, Vera is still stringing her pretty words together, changing the world around them in the only way she can. When her own eyes grow too heavy to keep open any longer, she kisses her sister's bloody palm, tasting the metallic blood mixed with the sweetness of the honey. She should have put some of the honey on her own blistered palm, but she didn't think of it. "Sleep now."
"Will we see Mama tomorrow?" Olga asks sleepily.
"Not tomorrow, no," Vera says, tightening her hold. "But soon." The day is sunny and bright. If not for the Germans bombing everything in sight,
and their tanks rolling forward, forward, the birds would be singing here. The pine trees would be green instead of black. As it is, the beauty of the place is long gone. The trench is a huge, gaping slash in the earth, a mortal, muddy wound. Girls crawl all around it. Soldiers run back and forth between here and the front line, not far away. If this line breaks, if the Germans get past it, Leningrad will fall. This they all believe, so they keep digging, no matter that their hands are bleeding and bombs are as ever-present as sunlight. Vera is trying not to think about anything except the spoon in her hand. The pickaxe broke last week. For a while, she was lucky enough to find a spade, but she didn't hide it well, and one morning when she woke up, it was gone. So now she digs with a serving spoon. All day long, stab, push, twist, pull, until her shoulder aches and her neck hurts and her blistered palms burn. No amount of salt water can help. The honey and the old woman are long gone. And now she is having her monthly bleeding as well. Her body is turning against her, it seems, and yet all she can worry about is Olga. Her sister digs without complaint, but she can't sleep or eat. And when the bombs start falling, Olga just stands there with a hand tented across her face, staring up at the plains. In the past few weeks, Vera has learned that anything can become ordinary. Sleeping in the dirt, running for cover, digging holes, watching people die, stepping over bodies, smelling flesh burn. But she cannot accept the new Olga, who moves like the blind and laughs giddily when bombs explode around her. The air raid alarm rings out. Girls and women scurry out of the trench and into it. They are screaming to one another, pushing each other aside. Olga is standing beside the trench, her dress torn and dirty. Her long strawberry blonde hair is filthy, frizzy, and held back from her blackened face by a once blue kerchief. Overhead, German planes begin to fill the sky, their engines droning. Vera yells for her sister as she scrambles over the broken earth, leading the way, pushing debris aside. Come on! It sounds like Mama's sewing machine. Vera turns at that, looks back. Olga is still standing there, too far away, her hand tented over her eyes. Run! Vera yells at the same time the bomb hits. Olga is there and gone, flung like a rag doll to the side. She falls in a broken heap on the other side of the trench while debris rains down. Vera is screaming, crying. She crawls out of the trench and over the broken earth to where her sister lies beneath a pile of dirt and rubble. A brick is on Olga's chest. Where did it come from? Blood gushes from the side of Olga's mouth and slides through the soot and mud on her cheek. Her breathing is a phlegmy, bubbling cough. Vera, she says, shuddering. I forgot to get down. You're supposed to listen to me, Vera says. She holds her sister to her chest, trying to keep her alive by loving her. I am your big sister. Always bossing. Vera kisses her sister's cheek, tries to wipe the blood away, but her hands are so dirty she is just making a mess. I love you, Olga. Don't leave me, please. Olga smiles and coughs. Blood gushes from her nose and mixes with dirt. Remember when we went? And she is gone. Vera sits there a long time, kneeling in the dirt, until the soldiers come and take Olga away. Then she goes back to digging. It isn't that she doesn't care or doesn't hurt. But what else can she do? 22.
In August, Vera is released from work on the line. She is one of thousands of dazed, solitary women walking in silent groups for home. The trains are still running, although most of them are full all the time, and only the luckiest find space enough to sit or stand. They are evacuating the children of Leningrad again, this time with their mothers. But Vera does not trust her government anymore and will not follow the evacuation order again. Only last week she heard of a train of children that was bombed near Maga. Maybe it is true, maybe it is not. She does not care. It could be true, and that is enough for her. She is tougher now, after 2 months spent digging in the black earth and running for shelter. Tough enough to make her way home through countryside she's never seen. When she is lucky, a transport or a lorry picks her up and takes her as far as they are going. But luck is a thing she has never counted on, and most of the miles to Leningrad she walks. When she meets soldiers on the road, she asks about Sasha, but she does not get answers. It is no surprise to her. When she finally makes it to Leningrad, she finds a city as changed as she. Windows are blacked out and crisscrossed in tape. Trenches cut through parks, tearing through grass and flowers. Everywhere she looks are mounds of broken cement. Dragon's teeth, they are called, meant to bar the tanks. Huge iron beams crisscross the city boundaries like the ugly, misplaced bars of a prison. And soldiers move in marching columns through the streets. Already many of them look as broken as she feels. They've lost on one front and are moving to another, closer to the city. In their tired eyes, she sees the same fear that is now lodged inside of her. Leningrad is not the impervious city they'd imagined her to be. The Germans are getting closer. Finally, Vera stands on her own street and looks up at her apartment. Except for the blacked-out windows, it looks as it always did. The trees out front are in full summer bloom, and the sky is as blue as a robin's egg. As she stands there, afraid to go forward, a feeling moves through her, as powerful as hunger or desire. She shivers with it. It is wanting to turn and run, to hold on to this terrible truth a little longer, but she knows that running will not help. So she takes a deep breath and walks forward, one step at a time, until she is at her own front door. It opens at her touch, and suddenly she is in her home again, as small and cluttered as it is. Never has the broken-down furniture and peeling paint looked so beautiful. And there is her mama, standing at the stove in a faded dress, with her gray hair all but hidden beneath a threadbare kerchief, stirring something. At Vera's entrance, she turns slowly. Her smile is heartbreaking. Worse is the way it fades away and is replaced by sorrow.
Mama! Leo screams, coming at her like a windstorm, toys dropping from his hands.
Anya is beside him in an instant, and they throw themselves into Vera's arms.
They smell so good, so pure.
Leo's cheeks are as soft and sweet as ripe plums, and Vera could eat him up. She holds them too long, too tightly, unaware that she has begun to shake and to cry.
"Don't cry, Mama," Anya says, wiping her cheek. "I still have the butterfly. I didn't break it."
Vera slowly releases them and stands up. She is shaking like a leaf and trying not to cry as she stares across the kitchen at her mother. In that look, Vera feels her childhood leave her at last.
"Where's Aunt Olga?"
Leo asks, looking past her. Vera cannot answer. She just stands there.
"Olga is gone," Mama says with only a slight tremble in her voice. She is a hero of the state, our Olga, and that is how we must think of her.
But,
Mama takes Vera in her arms, holding her so hard that neither can breathe. There is only silence between them. In that silence, memories pass back and forth like dye in water, moving and fluid, and when they pull back and look at each other, Vera understands. They will not speak of Olga again. Not for a long time. Not until the sharp pain rounds into something that can be handled. You need a bath, Mama says after a time. And those bandages on your hands need changing, so come along. Those first days back in Leningrad seem like a dream to Vera. During the day, she works alongside other library employees, packing up the most valuable books for transport. She, who is so low on the roster, finds herself actually holding a first edition of Anna Karenina. The pages have an unexpected weight, and she closes her eyes for just a moment. In the darkness, she sees Anna, dressed in jewels and furs, running across the snow to Count Vronsky. Someone says her name so sharply, she almost drops the treasured volume. Starting, she flushes and lowers her gaze to the floor, mumbling, "Sorry," and goes back to work. By the end of the week, they have packed up more than 350,000 masterpieces and sent them out of harm's way. They filled the attic with sandbags and moved other important works to the basement. Room after room is cleared out and boarded up and shut down, until only the smallest of the rooms is left open for readers. By the end of her shift, Vera's shoulders ache from all the lifting and dragging of boxes, but she is far from finished for the day. Instead of going home, she trudges through the busy camouflage streets and gets into the first queue she finds. She doesn't know what they are selling at this market, and she doesn't care. Since the start of bread rationing and the limitations placed on the withdrawal of banking accounts, you take what you can get. Like most of her friends and neighbors, Vera has very little money. Her rations allow her 400 grams of bread a day and 600 grams of butter a month. On this, they can live. But she thinks often of a decision she made years ago. If she worked now in the bread factory, her family would be better fed. She would be an essential worker with higher rations. She stands in line for hours. At just past 10 o'clock in the evening, she comes to the front. The only thing left for sale are jars of pickles, and she buys 3, the amount she can afford and carry. In the apartment, she finds her mother and grandmother sitting at the kitchen table, passing a cigarette back and forth between them. Saying nothing, they all say little these days, she goes past them to the children's beds. Leaning down, she kisses both tender cheeks. Exhausted and hungry, she goes back into the kitchen. Mama has put out a plate of cold kasha for her. The last transport left today, Baba says when Vera sits down. Vera looks at her grandmother. I thought they were still evacuating the city. Mama shakes her head. We could not decide, and now it is decided for us. The Germans have taken Maga. Vera knows what this means, and if she did not, the look of despair in her mother's eyes would have been enough to inform her. So? Leningrad is an island now, Mama says, taking a drag off the cigarette and handing it back to Baba. Cut off from the mainland on all sides. Cut off from supplies, Vera thinks. What do we do? Vera asks. Do? Baba says. Winter is coming, Mama says in the silence. We need food and a borjuita.
I will take the children and go to the marketplace tomorrow.
What will you trade?
My wedding ring, Mama says. So, it has begun, Baba says, stubbing out the cigarette. Vera sees the way they look at each other, the knowing sadness that passes between mother and daughter. And although it scares her, it comforts her too. They have been through this before, her mama and her babushka. War is nothing new to Peter's city. They will survive as they have survived before, by being careful and smart. The city becomes one long line. Everything is disappearing, especially politeness. Rations are consistently being cut, and often there is no food to be had, even with a ration card. Vera, like everyone else, is tired and hungry and afraid. She wakes at 4 in the morning to stand in line for bread, and after work, she walks miles to the outskirts of town, bartering with peasants for food. A liter of vodka for a bag of withered potatoes, an outgrown pair of valenki for a pound of lard, and digging up whatever forgotten vegetables she can find. It is not safe, and she knows it, but there is nothing to be done. This search for food is all there is. No one goes to the library anymore, but Vera must keep working there to keep her workers' rations. Now she is on her way home from the country. She moves quickly, keeping to the shadows with her precious bag of potatoes hidden inside her dress like an unborn baby. She is less than a mile from the apartment when the air raid alarm goes off, blaring through the nearly empty city streets. When it stops, she can hear the planes buzzing, growing closer. She hears a loud whistling and starts to run for one of the trenches in the park to her left. Before she is even across the street, something explodes. Dirt and debris rain down from the sky. One building after another is destroyed. And then, silence. Vera gets up slowly, her legs unsteady. The potatoes are okay. She crawls out of the trench. Dusting herself off, she runs for home. The city is burning and smoking around her. People are screaming and crying. She turns the corner and sees her apartment building. It is intact. But the building next door is demolished. Only half of it remains. The other side is a pile of smoking, pulverized rubble. As she draws near, she sees a living room in perfect shape. Green flowered wallpaper still in place, a table still set for dinner, a painting on the wall. But no people. As she stands there, the chandelier above the table shudders and falls, crashing across the dishes on the table. She finds her family in the basement, huddled alongside their neighbors. When the all clear sounds, they go back upstairs and put the children in bed. It is only the beginning. The next day, Vera goes with her mother and the children to the market, where they search for Berzhuika. Without such a stove, her mother says, they will have problems come winter. They find one deep in the back of the market, in a stall run by the kind of people Vera normally would never see. Swarthy, drunken men and women wearing jewels they surely hadn't owned a week ago. Vera holds her children close, trying not to make a face as the man's vodka breath washes over her. "This is the last one," he says, leering at her, swaying. Mama takes off her wedding ring. The gold shines dully in the morning light. "I have this gold ring," she says. "What good is gold?" he sneers. "The war won't last forever," Mama says. "And there's more." She opens her coat and pulls out a large jar full of white sugar. The man stares at it. Sugar is like gold dust now.
Baba or Mama must have stolen it from the warehouse where they work. The man's ham-sized fist snakes out. His fingers coil around the jar and pull it back. Mama hardly seems to care that her ring is gone, that a man like that has possession of it. Together, the four of them drag the stove and pipe back to their apartment, pull it up the stairs in clanging bursts. When it is up and in place, its vent going out the window, Mama clasps her hands. "That's that," she says, coughing. The stove is a small, ugly thing, cast iron with a pair of drawers that jut out brokenly. A long metal pipe goes from the stove, up the side of the wall, and out through a newly cut hole. She finds it hard to believe that it is worth a woman's wedding ring. "That was a lot of sugar," Vera says quietly as Mama walks past her. "Yes," Mama says, pausing. "Baba brought it to us."
"She could get in trouble," Vera whispers, moving closer.
"The Badaev warehouses is watched. Almost all of the city's food stores are there, and both of you are employees. If one of you gets in trouble..." "Yes," Mama says, looking at her hard. "She is still there now, working late. She will be the last one to leave."
"But you do not yet know," Mama says, coughing again. It is a hacking, bubbly sound that unaccountably makes Vera think of muddy rivers and hot weather. "Are you okay, Mama?"
"I am fine. It is just the dust in the air from the bombings." Before Vera can answer, or even think of what to say, the air raid alarm sounds.
"Children," she screams, "come quickly."
Vera grabs the coats from the wall and bundles her children up.
"I don't want to go to the basement," Leo whines. "It stinks down there."
"Mrs. Nevsky is the one who stinks," Anya says, and her frown turns to a smile. Leo giggles.
"She smells like cabbage."
"Hush," Vera says, wondering how long this childhood will last for her babies. She buttons Leo's coat and takes his hand. Out in the hallway, the neighbors are already lining up for the stairs. On all of their faces is the same look, a combination of fear and resignation. No one really believes that being in the basement will save them from a bomb falling on their building. But at a time like this, there is no other salvation. So they go. Vera kisses each of her children, hugs them fiercely in turn, and then hands them over to Mama. While her family and neighbors go down to save themselves, Vera goes up. Breathing hard, she runs up the dirty, dark staircase and emerges onto the flat, litter-strewn roof. A long pair of iron tongs and several buckets full of sand are in place along the short wall. From here, she can see across Leningrad to the south. In the distance are the plains. Not one or two as before, but dozens. At first they are tiny black dots, dodging between giant barrage balloons that hang above the city, but soon she can see their shiny propellers and the details on their tails. Bombs fall like raindrops. In their wake, puffs of smoke and flashes of fire. A plane is overhead. Vera looks up, sees its glistening silver belly open up. Incendiary bombs drop out. She watches in horror as one lands not more than 15 feet from where she is standing. She runs for it, hearing its hiss. Her foot catches on a piece of wood, and she falls to the ground so hard she tastes blood. Scrambling back up, she reaches for the gloves in her pocket and puts them on, shaking, trying to hurry. Then she grabs up the iron tongs and tries to use them to pick up the bomb. It is an intricate task. She takes too long and fire catches on the wooden beam beneath the bomb. Smoke rises up. She positions the tongs on the bomb. The heat on her face is terrifying. She's sweating so she can hardly see. Still, she clamps the handles and lifts the long bomb and throws it off the side of the building. It lands with a thud on the grass below, where it can do no real damage. Dropping the tongs, she runs back to the small fire started by the bomb and stomps the flames out with the soles of her shoes, then pours sand on it. When the fire is out, she drops to her knees. Her heart is going a mile a minute, and her cheeks feel singed by the heat. If she hadn't been here, that bomb would have burned its way down through the building, falling from floor to floor and leaving fire in its wake. The basement is where it would have ended up. In that tiny room, jam-packed with people. With her family. She stays there, kneeling on the hard surface of the roof as night falls. The whole city seems to be on fire. Smoke rolls upward and out. Even after the airplanes are gone, the smoke remains, growing thicker and redder. Bright yellow and orange flames flicker up between the buildings, lick at the smoke's swollen underbelly. When the all clear finally sounds, Vera is too shaken to move. It is only the thought of her children, who are probably crying now and afraid, that makes her move. One shaking step at a time, she walks across the roof and down the stairs to her apartment, where her family is already waiting for her.
"Did you see the fires?" Anya asks, biting her lip. "They are far away from here," Vera says, smiling as brightly as she can. "We are safe."
"Will you tell us a story, Mama?"
Leo says, popping his thumb in his mouth. His eyes lower sleepily and reopen. Vera scoops both her children into her arms, settles one on each hip. She doesn't bother to brush their teeth, just puts them to bed and climbs in with them. At the table in the living room, Mama sits down and lights up her one cigarette for the day. The smell of it is lost in the overwhelming scent of the city burning. There is something almost sweet in the air. A smell like caramel left too long on the hot stove. Vera tightens her hold on her children. "There is a peasant girl," she says, trying to sound calm. It is hard. Her thoughts are tangled up in what could have happened, what she could have lost. And she would swear that she can still hear that bomb whistling toward her, rustling impossibly in flight and banging down beside her.